first by Mike West from Duke, with the title Sparsity Modeling Gene Expression in Pathways Studies.
Thank you, Søren. Well, welcome back. When Peter invited me to give a talk here, there was a stern directive attached to the email that I should speak to the biologists and that I should speak at a very elementary level statistically. So I took that to heart. This talk is for the biologists. Statisticians can stay if you want. So what I decided to do is just to pull a few vignettes from a number of studies that we've been involved in over the last 8.5 years in gene expression genomics, and just talk about some of the biological issues, not issues, ideas, concepts, cancer genomics, cardiovascular genomics in particular, and basic experimental studies associated with those disease areas. And I'll just tell you that there's some statistics underneath, and I'll try and give you some idea, the biologists, as to what it is. It's basically regression models and how we use them, just in case you happen to have some problems that might have similar characteristics, goals, ambitions biologically, and you might be interested in learning more of the statistics. So sparse statistical models in pathway biology, 2 slides, 3 slides, just to set the stage. A sparse statistical model for a big set of data, it'll all be gene expression, is simply a statistical model, a regression model with many, many parameters. Okay, so thetas might be average change in expression of a gene or a few thousand genes. Lots of parameters, most of which are zero. So the canonical, high-dimensional, highly parameterized model in which most of the stuff is there mathematically, but in actuality it's not, and you want to figure out where the action is, okay, and estimate the thetas that are non-zero. So the two examples are regression analysis of variance. It's just that it's multivariate because the response is high dimensional, and factor analysis, which is the same. It's just that the predictors, the stuff on the right-hand side of a regression equation, the independent variables, are themselves things you have to estimate. So the machinery, this has come off the side. Sorry about that. The machinery is Bayesian inference, probabilistic inference, in these kinds of models where there's models on theta as well. Some people call them prior distributions, I call them models. And we're interested in the sort of canonical problems of parameter estimation when lots of them aren't there. So we can call that variable selection, multiple comparisons, all of that general mix of multivariate analysis. The machinery, the engine of the calculations, is Markov chain Monte Carlo and other methods of stochastic search in high-dimensional spaces that thetas inhabit, okay, which have very many degeneracies in many dimensions that we're trying to isolate. So sparse statistical models. Pathway biology, what do I mean by that? I'm not a biologist, and I know the term pathway is hugely loaded and contentious. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about some of the perspective of some of our studies over the year with many, many biologists at Duke and elsewhere. And we'll talk about some examples of looking in vitro experiments in a cell culture or a cell line in cancer at an intervention, a knockout, or an upregulation of a transcription factor that elicits a transcriptional response, and asking questions about what are the genes in that response and can we characterize it numerically and look at it in some other context. Okay, and the other context being when one is working in disease-related areas, human tumors or human tissue in a study of atherosclerosis, for example. So we're very interested in moving between contexts, moving from in vitro to human observational data, all gene expression today, and asking questions about what we learn in terms of gene expression studies in the lab, how that translates maybe to animal models, how it translates to humans. I'll give you several insights, again, just vignettes from some of our studies. And when you get into this business, well, whether you're in it or not, in any one context, very often one is interested in combining data sets from different experiments or the same experiment at different times or with different technicians or different reagents. And the biologists know what I'm talking about. The sensitivity of expression assays, gene expression array-based assays in particular, you can be on Venus and Mars in the same lab context on different days just with very small changes in the environment. So For that alone, and then when we start combining data sets from different sources together, one has to be very interested in questions of calibration, normalization, cross-normalization. I'm going to say very little on that today, just two or three slides with pictures. It's a cornerstone of a lot of our work over the years, very important to us. These are the two of the primary funding umbrellas we have: the NCI Systems Biology, Cancer Biology program that we have at Duke, and a parallel older cardiovascular program. And I'll be taking data and examples that have been developed under both of those. So here's a pathway. Here's a cartoon of the RBE2F pathway, which is many, many, many genes that are involved in the whole business of cell cycle development and cell control, cell proliferation, cell death. And I'll be talking about a few of these genes a little bit as we go through. So one of my favorite genes is a transcription factor MYC that sits in the cartoon at the top of this pathway. Here's an E2F family of transcription factors. It's a cartoon that names a few genes and says they're all sort of related in important ways. And it's central to all human cancers. Okay. So gene expression profiling, the way, sort of canonical way that a lot of people think about it, involves defining signatures of an intervention or an outcome. Okay, so let's just describe that in this kind of context. You jump in and you knock out MYC, or you upregulate MYC. And you ask the question, let's do that five times in replicate, let's do it five times without that intervention, control and treatment. Let's ask what genes are up or down with respect to that intervention, and let's pull out some of those genes. Okay, so that's what these pictures are. So here's a set of genes that are up in the control, down in MYC, and down in the control, up in MYC. You could do it with other nodes in a network. So a signature, an in vitro signature for us today, is simply a set of genes that you choose from this kind of experiment, 50, 100, I don't care, and a numerical way of averaging them, just putting them together to get a single number, so that if you can then assay another group of cells or a tissue from a tumor, you can, in principle, measure that signature on that set of cells or that tumor. So you can move between contexts with gene expression as a common currency. That's all a signature is, a gene expression signature is for me today. So when we start looking at tens of thousands of genes on a microarray, and start thinking about this statistically, the sparsity is a given. So here's a picture from an experiment that I'll revisit three times today. This is a log to a fold change scale for expression. This is experiments. So I've got 100 dishes with cells growing in them, breast epithelial cells, in batches of about 8 to 10 replicates. The first 10 are controls, so this 7 is the average level of gene expression for that gene, okay, in the wild-type cell. The next 10 here represent MYC interventions. So MYC was overexpressed, there's an expression response elicited across all genes, this gene happened to go up with MYC in this picture. And all I've done is draw a line at the average, roughly. And the other color-coded dots represent batches of other interventions on other nodes in the network, and nothing's changing. Okay, so there's about 10 interventions. Okay, it's a one-way analysis of variance with 10 treatments, and only one of them hits this gene. Okay, there are many genes that show no response to any of these interventions. Okay, so that's your sparsity. You're interested in signatures of these interventions to characterize a MYC upregulated state or a RAS upregulated state. And because we're dealing with many genes, we're in a problem of multiple comparisons where we want to figure out how to deal with enforcing sparsity qualitatively and letting the data tell us where it is. This is taken from a Nature paper of ours a few years ago. Okay. So we're interested in that kind of experiment, lots and lots of them. And one of the reasons we're interested is we want to then ask questions about reality. Okay, this pathway is at the center of lots of cancer. It's the cell proliferation control and fate pathway. Okay, it's the engine of cell growth. And lots of little bits of it go cranky in lots of ways and contribute towards the development of differential levels of aggressiveness of cancerous states. So if one wants to then ask the question, what is the MYC state or the RAS state, or whatever it is, of this cancer and this cancer and this cancer, you have to then look at data from cancers, from primary biopsies in this case, and ask how does that gene expression signature now as a biomarker of that state play out in the cancers. So that's what we're interested in. You can then imagine then taking the MYC signature and evaluating it across 300 breast cancers, ordered so that it runs from red to blue, high to low across these cancers. And then ask the question, well, how does this numeric signature, when evaluated in the breast cancers, relate to things of interest, such as recurrence of the cancer, aggressiveness measured in different ways, responsiveness to various drugs, time until death, okay? And this is just a Kaplan-Meier taking one of those signatures saying it's high, low at the 50% point. And for those of you that are Kaplan-Meier, so as we go along the time in years here, the value of this curve is the probability that an individual lives recurrence-free until that time point. So high is good and low is bad. Okay, and just stratifying about 300 breast cancers in one sample study on the midpoint of a particular signature, one pulls apart two subsets of the patients, high risk, low risk, with respect to recurrence. We've got a number of studies that are involved in drug responsiveness, where the same kind of idea can be played out. Does a projected gene expression signature of a MYC event or a MYC upregulation seem to relate to the responsiveness to drug A, drug B, drug C? Okay, hundreds and hundreds of drugs in cancer. Thousands. Most of them are very low efficacy, even in combination with others. And there's a lot of interest in refining that and improving the efficacy by using this kind of data and other kinds of molecular information to improve the decisions about cocktails of drugs. So that's really just a brief introduction. I'm going to move into statistics a bit now, although there's no maths. We've been doing this kind of work for about 7 years, and this is just a picture from the Genome Institute website at Duke, which is a timeline for a number of clinical trials, all of which are being guided by gene expression and other forms of genomic signature definition. In particular, I'll point out one down here, which is a lung trial just about to start, which is asking questions about how can we improve outcomes in lung cancer with just small changes in the way drug choices are made based on a genomic predictor. Okay, so this stuff is beginning to be really, really quite real. Okay, so that's the introduction. That's why I'm interested in this stuff and some of what we do. This is as tough as it gets mathematically. Okay, this is my mathematical slide. Well, there's one more, but nothing much more than this. So genes are rows, samples are columns. That's my X matrix. Each of these, each row is a standard univariate analysis of variance. Gene 1 is a linear combination defined by known 0, 1 indicators in H of some parameters, some betas. So J equals 1 is MYC. Beta G1 is the expected change in expression of gene 1, of gene G, as a result of that MYC intervention. Okay? Beta G2 is RAS, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a set of parameters for each gene, a big matrix, tall, skinny matrix. We want to estimate that matrix. Okay? That's part of the statistical problem. I'll give you a more elaborate analysis of variance in a minute where it's slightly more interesting because there are more than one. It's more than a one-way analysis of variance. But it's a multiple comparisons problem because most of that is empty. Most of the genes in the genome don't respond to any of these interventions. Okay? So we've got to build in machinery into the statistical analysis to allow us to do that. And there are a number of ways you can do that. Okay, so we saw some of that this morning, one of the talks. Bayesian thinking, one version of it, says, well, what we want to do is to characterize this array of parameters by another array of parameters, which is a set of probabilities. Each gene factor pair has a probability of having a non-zero effect. Okay, and in our models, those probabilities can be zero. Some of them are going to be zero. Many of them are going to be zero. Some of them will be non-zero and small. And some of them, hopefully, if there's action there, will be high. Okay, so the probabilities underlie the parameters, and the statistical analysis is going to get matrices like this, estimates, if you like, in our case, samples from posterior distributions, of the beta matrix and the pi matrix that are coupled together to summarize our data analysis. And one picture we're fond of drawing is this one. This is just a picture of such a pi matrix where you can look down a column one, and say this is the MYC column, and black means zero and white means one, just thresholding estimates of these probabilities to look at, well, is there any action there? Are there any pis that are bigger than 0.3 or 0.7 or 0.99999? Okay? a skeleton of the gene factor association evident in this data. You can reorganize the rows to make it pretty to really show you the sparsity, and as importantly often, the crosstalk, that there may be genes involved in a MYC response that are also part of the response to another intervention. And that begins to get into the pathway structure, the biological pathway structure underlying these interventions. And if you find, so the statistical analysis delivers estimates and information about pi's, and if you find interesting pi's that are high, you want to know what the betas are. Okay, so there are corresponding statistical components that allow you to look at what the numbers are. This is just standard bread and butter applied statistics from one point of view. It's hierarchical Bayesian modeling. And we can have conversations about the theoretical, methodological, philosophical foundations, etc. It's just basic applied statistics for the purpose of this talk. We can do these things. We can do these calculations. So here's my second example. This is an old example now, published in several different places in different aspects. There's a large project on cardiovascular, looking at atherosclerosis, the development of scaling in the arteries. Okay, we all have it. The older white guys have it more than the others. This is a study that involved 4 or 5 years study on a whole range of experiments. Some of them having to do with gene expression from the main aorta of mice. So I'm going to show you some mice. It's interesting because we want to link across to humans, and we have human data, and I'll show you some human data from heart donors at Duke University who died for reasons other than cardiovascular, motorcycle accidents and so forth. And we're in this study now, and I'm not going to show you any of this today, that's a whole other talk, is asking questions how that relates to what we see in blood samples. Because if this project and projects like it develop biomarkers of different levels of development of atherosclerosis, and I can be assayed in my blood to figure out how bad my atherosclerosis is, that's much preferable to having the assay come from inside my main aorta. So it's really, really challenging to move a lot of molecular discovery that's done in vitro and in animal models and in human tissues into practice if it has to be done in blood, as most of it does. So. Anyway, so here's the mice. Very well designed, very rich experiment. It's a 2-to-4 design, so there are 4 factors, completely balanced, at least 8 mice in each box. Okay, I designed it. I wouldn't play without 4-fold replicate at least. And it's interesting because there are mice here that have really advanced disease. We verify that by looking inside the aorta when the gene expression samples are taken. But it's designed to really give you a spectrum. There are young mice and there are old mice. Age is a risk factor. There are male mice and there are female mice. Being male is a risk factor for atherosclerosis. There are mice that eat a really good diet, a standard mouse diet, whatever that is. And there are mice that eat the equivalent of mice hamburgers every day, and a lot of them. Okay, and that's bad. That's a risk factor. So it's a gene-environment interaction study, okay, in essence. And then half the mice have lost a gene called APOE. And many of you biologists will know about APOE. It does lots of things, but some of the things it does are really control mechanisms on the lipid metabolism, in particular on the uptake of cholesterols. Okay? So if you happen to be APOE deficient, you're in trouble almost from the start. Okay? So looking at APOE knockout, older male mice who eat the hamburgers, you've got advanced disease state. Okay. So the mice are sacrificed, gene expression is made from their aorta, the disease state is verified, and then you're in the business of looking at this slightly more interesting analysis of variance, where each gene, single gene, has an average level in some baseline arbitrarily defined. Then there's an effect due to sex, difference between males and females. Well, most of the mutes are going to be zero, okay, just a few genes that are sex-related. And then there are main effects and second-order interaction effects and third-order interaction effects and, of course, a lot of noise that defines an overall analysis of variance, the most general model you can imagine. Okay, and we're interested in these interactions. We're interested in genes that show a difference in expression, for example, only if you're male and you eat hamburgers. Okay, to begin to understand how big how big that set of environmental factors and one biological factor really is. And we've got to do this. This is old data. This was several years ago. So there's only 12,500 genes on this array at the time, but it's the same general problem. So this is another way of looking at outputs from these kinds of analyses. Forget about the last three columns. I'll talk about those in a minute. So each gene, has 16 parameters, an average, an effective sex, an effective age, an effective diet, the second order, third order interactions. There are 16 of those in total, and there's other things involved, of course. And these are just box plots for each of those effects. And I'm going to look at one of them, just to hit this idea of signature again. I'm going to say, well, let's look at the APOE knockout mice that are older, the second order interaction, irrespective of everything else. And what this box plot is, it's telling you that this is a box plot of the estimates of these probabilities, the sparsity probabilities. If a pi is non-zero, it's telling you the probability that there's an effect on this particular gene due to this particular combination of factors. So if we look at this box plot, most of them are really down here near zero, but there's a line. This is just MATLAB box plot. There's nothing in the middle. There's a few up here. That's why the line is there. Okay? We might ask the question, well, let's go up here and pull out, let's see who's up there. And you only have to go up to about 0.8. There's really nobody between 0.1 and 0.8. And then there are a few genes right at the top. So the probabilities, as they've been estimated, are really coming to two groups. A huge group that's stuffed up against zero, most of the genes, and then a few at the top. Okay, so you can look at these genes. Arbitrarily choose how many you want to look at. For example, if you choose it this way, there are 40 genes that define a signature of the APOE age interaction. Okay, so it's the same kind of idea. And you can see here, you can't at the back, but these are the wild type are the first half of the mice, the APOE are the second half of the mice. And within each of those two groups, the younger ones are first and the older ones are second. So the APOE knockout older mice give you this red blob here. So these are genes that are up for that interaction group and down otherwise. And there are some up here that tend to be down in the interaction group more than otherwise, okay? So this is the sparsity analysis of driven analysis of variance pulling out a signature in a slightly more interesting analysis of variance model. The signature itself, you can define it in various ways. You can take those 40 genes and do a principal component, pull out the first component. We don't do that. We do similar kinds of calculations. Some weighted average of those 40 genes across samples gives you a numeric signature, which shows you that the APOE older mice have a high value of that signature. There's one peculiar younger mouse down here that happens to have evidence of a slightly elevated risk signature. Why is it a risk signature? It's a biomarker of moderate development of atherosclerosis. Okay, the older mice that are APOE knockout have got this disease. Okay, if they're eating hamburgers as well, they've got a lot of it. Okay, so a signature is now a biomarker of a disease state. Okay, going to go over to the human data in a second, but for those of you that are interested in such things, I'm going to show you a few more pictures like this later on. The model allows you to interrogate individual genes. So these are two genes from that signature gene set. Some of you may know them. VCAM1 is involved in tissue remodeling. And as the process of lesion development and so forth, the buildup of plaque in the aorta develops, tissue is being remodeled aggressively, more and more. Okay, it's a well-known biomarker of atherosclerosis. And what this picture is showing us is across the samples, and remember that the diseased mice are over here, expression in this gene is fluctuating, and what this is doing is decomposing it, and each of these lines is on the same scale, so that expression from this gene is a linear sum of noise, and zero except for the APOE older mice. And there's also a contribution coming in here for the APOE older hamburger-fed mice. So this is a gene that's showing a second and a third order interaction. It changes, it goes up in expression as a result of being in this modest disease state, APOE knockout and old. And then it goes up much more if you happen to be eating hamburgers as well. Okay? So we're beginning to see how individual genes and their transcriptional response play out by dissecting the analysis of variance through the higher order interactions. Here's another one, which shows an elevation in the group we're interested in the third order interaction group. And noise, and there's another contribution here, and I put this one on because I'm going to be talking about this. This has to do with this business of experimental variation that's a distraction that's not part of the biology that we model out in using these kinds of models. And I'll come back to that in a few minutes. To continue with the example, then, here's that same signature, or maybe a slightly different version of it. This is the third-order signature. So these are the diseased mice in red, and these are the less diseased mice in blue. We're now going to go over to the human hearts, okay, where from a couple of hundred donors, we've got gene expression. And this is really random sampling. You're just getting what, you know, comes to the path lab. People who die for other reasons who've donated their organs, and people who've died through accidents who've donated their organs, and so forth. So we can take the signature gene set and map it over with all kinds of caveats and considerations. And we can look inside the aorta of these human hearts and try and figure out some measure of extent of development of atherosclerosis and say, well, does the signature sort of relate at all to the variation we see in the humans? And that's what this is. So there was a designation of lesions in this heart, no lesion, in this aorta, lesions versus no lesions, or advanced lesions versus almost no or limited development of lesions. And that's the cyan and the pink. And you begin to see the suspicion that the mouse model-based biomarker of advanced disease state is allowing you to not stratify, but pick up some variation across the human sample. And we can do this with all of the signatures, okay? So here's a signature of APOE, here's a signature of age, here's a signature of male versus female, now evaluated across the human samples, projected and evaluated, okay? And, you know, you can predict who the men and who the women are from this, but you can also then line this up with this measure of extent of development of disease in this purely observational study. We're not doing any kind of inference here, we're just looking at data, and see that the disease biomarkers in the mouse model, the APOE risk factor interaction terms, are beginning to show some association with the extent of disease in the humans. Okay? So it's sort of suggestive that there's some value in going down this line, however messy the data is, and however many questions we have about how we're going to go down this line any further. That's all I'm going to say about this example for today. I'm happy to talk in much more about many more aspects of this for anybody that's interested in it. I will say that the study now is, of course, looking at human blood and doing this kind of thing and trying to figure out if we can see the same kinds and maybe even improved resolution with newer expression technologies, the same kind of link-up of in vitro or animal model, in this case, to find signatures of risk in human blood samples that then give us some indication of what's going on inside the heart. A little bit of a sidestep then to talk about this issue of crap in data, noise in data that you've got to be aware of because it can be considerable. Same theme, just the same regression model, it's just the H matrix now. It might have some numbers in it that you specify that are not just binaries to design the experiment. They could be measured covariates. So back to the oncogene study, the MYC, the RAS, et cetera, the one-way analysis of variants, same data. These are the samples running across here. The first 10 are controls. So imagine this is gene expression on one gene. The first 10 are controls. Here's the MYC group, the blues. Over here, the light greens are the RAS group, et cetera, et cetera. The first set of experiments was done over a period of about 8 months. About a year later, we did a second set of experiments. These data have been put together and subject to all of the acceptedly interesting normalization methods, including many of our own, that you can imagine. So those of you that do expression work will know what I mean. There's lots of ways you can play those games, and we've done it all. Okay, and you've still got a big study effect. Well, it's much more complicated than that. If you look down here, think about this as another gene, same scenario, maybe you can see suspicion of a study effect here, but this is the second study too. This is part of the second study. This is the second study. This stuff's going up here too. These arrows indicate five observations, which are also controls. So they should look like the first 10. There were five additional controls that were not run as part of the first study, but that were run as part of the second phase. Okay? On this expression scale, they look sort of more like the first study than the second. So they're not really operating as controls as they were anticipated to. And over here, we don't know what's going on. Okay? These are not genes. These two pictures are the first two principal components of a set of housekeeping probes on this array. Okay, this is Affymetrix's data. And there's lots of questions about how you choose them, but there's information on the arrays that is putatively giving you a stable expression readout. Either nothing should be there, or the gene should be expressed at a constant high level. Okay, they shouldn't be varying across samples. So you can pick up experimental artifact, as we call it, assay artifact, that is due to small variations in protocols in the lab, different kinds of chemicals, different time of day, different labs, different studies, different contexts, cell lines, mice, breast tumors, that add to the statistical machinery that we have available to help pull things together and co-normalize things. Okay, and you can think about doing it in different ways. We just put it in the model. Okay. It's sparse because many, many, many genes don't show any association with these readouts of artifact. And some show some limited association with one of them. Okay? So it's important to be going in with a mindset that we'll be using such information in a model-based correction automatically only when it matters, only when the data says it matters. So those regression relationships are going to be sparse as well. Here's an example of one. It could go either way. You can lose signal, or you can generate lots of false alarms. Okay, and this is the latter. Here is a gene. It's a nuclear factor that's upregulated by MYC. It's known to be regulated by MYC. Okay, it's got a MYC binding site and its promoter. And we've studied the literature on this gene, I know, more extensively than anybody else in the world, because we wanted to know what else it might be responding to in these experiments. Because when you look at the data, this is it. This is the expression across samples. This is the MYC upgroup. Certainly, there's a response. It goes up with MYC, so do the controls, the second set of controls. But then it's all over the map with respect to the other interventions. It looks as though this gene is downstream of everything we chose. Okay? But there's no known biology and no known literature, and there's no sequence information that we can find that tells us that it should be responsive to any of that stuff except MYC. Okay? So if you ignore the potential for assay artifact, and it's pretty clear here given that we've got two phases of the study, you get that picture. If you take it into account in a sparse regression term, just like the sparse analysis of variance, this is what you get. It finds a roughly doubling of expression for this gene as a response to the MYC upregulation. Okay, now the doubling is just a number. We knew it should go up. And it wipes out everything else, attributes it to artifact. Okay. I took out several slides just before this talk because I had way too many, and I've got lots of slides that if you don't know about this stuff, they will be very, very scary slides for you, putting together lots of different breast cancer samples, for example. And it really is, you know, different universes until you start looking at the housekeeping information on these genes. Okay.
So can I ask a stupid question, I guess? The housekeeping genes are they're a set of genes that people think should have constant level X. Is that correct?
So there's a set of actins, there's non-human genes on the human array, and then there's a whole set of genes, probe sets, not genes necessarily, some genes, some not, that Affymetrix spent several years assaying across many, many different conditions in many different tissues and publish as housekeeping genes. Now, caveat, I don't believe most of what they say, okay? So we've reproduced that kind of study, and we have a much more refined selection of probes that we use.
But just again, not necessarily going into details, just for the intuition, there's a transformation from the top thing to the bottom thing that you've done using these other probes elsewhere. And do you basically, just again in a very naive way, do you take the probes, these housekeeping things, and globally move an array up or down?
Nope. It's gene sample specific. So here is an example of how it works out. Across, going back to the mice sample, here's expression on TNFR. Over the mice samples, the analysis of variance says there's some potential effect of the design, the environmental interaction effects that we're looking for. There's noise, and then there's a set of regression terms that have regression coefficients that may be zero. Most of them are. And now and again, we'll find something that we think is non-zero. And this is the effect on the same scale, each of these is on the same vertical scale, of the contribution of this control factor based on the housekeeping information that corrects that assay artifact that says this gene shows a significant association with that pattern of variation of control probes across the samples, this gene. And it shows it as pretty much zero along here, and then there's a blip for this set of samples, and these were, this is in the order that the data was generated, so there's a temporal relationship there, and then it's zero again.
Okay. Sorry, my intuition is not helping me here a little bit, so let me just see if I can do this. The signal that you're picking up here when you do this is because, in effect, inside of each set of assay conditions, there are n number of replicates, and inside of those n number of replicates...
has nothing to do with the replication. No, each sample, each mouse, each array, has on it some control probes.
Yeah.
Think about them as a set of genes, right?
Yep.
Let's just take one of them,
sure.
Okay? And let's say when I look at all of the other genes, if I see variation in another gene that sort of looks like the variation I see in that gene across the samples, then I'm going to attribute that to artifact.
I see. Okay. I got it now. Okay.
Okay. So that's that, that story. And that stuff underlies all of our data analysis. We always have that in. I want to now go back to the question of mapping stuff over to human tumors or human hearts, natural variability, okay? In the context of the oncogene, so here's MICUP. I pull out my signature gene set, 100 genes, and this is simply a heat map of correlations. So these genes are all highly positively correlated. This is pairwise correlation being imaged. They're negatively correlated with genes down here, which are themselves, of course, positively correlated. There's a one-dimensional phenomenon. You know, there's a set of cells that are grown as a result of a response to induce higher levels of MYC. The pathway is lit up. Lots of genes show a response. That's your signature. There's a one-dimensional action. Then you throw that into a breast cancer sample. Okay? There's other things going on. Okay? These are living tumors. Well, they were living tumors before they were removed. Okay? And there's all kinds of interactions at the molecular level that were evident in the tumor when you snapshot it at surgery and throw it on a gene expression array. Okay? These genes that are involved in the MYC signature in that one-dimensional in vitro response play all kinds of roles in other connectivities in the network of pathways in living tissue. So you do the same calculation of pairwise correlation and reorganize the genes a bit, you get something that's much more interesting. Okay, you get pictures that you're used to looking at when you do clustering, if you do clustering. Same set of signature genes. So when we do the signature projection, we're going from the lab to the field, okay? And we have to admit that it's going to be more interesting, okay? And it's not just a simple question of what is the MYC signature, because the MYC signature is now multidimensional. And it's highlighting interactions of the MYC pathway with other pathways that may in fact be relevant for you to consider when you start asking the question about what is happening in terms of the stratification of individuals with respect to MYC. Because it's not now one-dimensional. So what we're seeing there is the complexity of biological variation, the heterogeneity of transcriptional activity in snapshots of human tumors. And one way we've been thinking about modeling these data now for nearly 8 years is with the same kinds of ideas, sparse regression, but now in which the regression variables, the independent variables, are latent factors, are things that we don't know. Okay? This picture says the genes up here seem to be positively associated, maybe very little association with other things, but maybe there's some down here they have some association with. Maybe that set of 10, 15 genes has sort of two dimensions. We go down here, this set of genes here is highly positively correlated within it, this set of, say, 10 genes. Maybe one or two other sets of genes that it shows some association with. Maybe that's a three-dimensional subset. There's some set of low-dimensional organizing factors that these genes seem to be related to in terms purely in terms of their patterns of expression in the human tumor data. So a factor model, one factor model, says that on tumor I for gene G, there's a regression relationship. You can predict that expression variation through a set of factors, 3, 5, 84, some number we're going to have to try and think about. And we're going to go and estimate this in a regression framework by estimating betas, okay? There may be a dozen factors that you need here, but any one gene may only need one of them, or two of them, or three of them. These factors are going to be relevant because they show up, each factor shows up in more than one gene, but any one gene may only share one or two of them. So there's a sparsity of interconnections there. And we'll be talking loosely using the metaphor, but what we see here is pathway biology in action, and what we're trying to do here is simply represent statistically the variation and expression patterns that arise from that biology, okay? Sub-pathway activation. The sparsity statistical modeling that I just described, regression analysis of variance, the same ideas hold. I'll say a few more words on that in a second. Okay. So for gene G, sample I, we're talking now about breast tumors. Okay. There's a set of factors, and each factor is realized on each tumor, and a set of coefficients, and it's precisely like the regression framework. Okay. We're going to overlay it with a set of probabilities, many of which may be zero. We're going to estimate those probabilities and those betas. And the picture you have in mind, in terms of the sparse latent factor model, is that genes are grouped together according to a factor. Okay, well, that's not factor analysis, that's clustering. There are interconnections. Okay, various pathways leading to activation. Any one gene may share, may play a role in more than one pathway. The statistical machinery is precisely the same. The only difference now is that we have to think about models for the latent factors. And I'll say a few more words about that later on. But in terms of model fitting, computation, the whole business of hierarchical modeling, multiple comparisons, all of that stuff, it's effectively the same. It's an extension of sparse regression. And again, I've said it twice, I'll say it three times. So all we're doing here is representing all of the relevant patterns that we see in the data in terms of as many factors as we need to soak up that variation. And we will have artifact predictors in there as well to deal with systematic variation that we want to say is attributable to experimental artifact. Okay. And then we'll have noise. An analysis generates the same kinds of pictures as I described earlier. So for example, here's an analysis from one of our breast cancer analyses where we've got a set of genes, a couple hundred genes, and about 10 or 15 factors, and the white is showing genes that relate to factor 1 in the first column, genes that relate to factor 2, factor 3, factor 4, factor 5, ordered so it looks pretty, and it's showing the crosstalk. So a gene may play in more than one factor and vice versa, and this is just a skeleton, it's just a picture. There's lots of other information from the analysis you might want to dig out. And the model allows you to do a decomposition, because you estimate the betas, many of which will be zero, you estimate the Fs as they vary across tumors. So it gives you a decomposition analogous to the analysis of variance decomposition. You can jump in and look at genes. So I'll give you a vignette from breast cancer that some of you may know a little bit about that just helps fix ideas. This is cyclin D. It was mentioned yesterday a couple of times in one of the talks. transcription factor that plays a role. It plays a number of roles. Its main role is really in the early phase of mammalian cell cycle. And so across 300 breast tumors, expression arrays, we pulled out, from a factor analysis, we pulled out cyclin D. The pattern of expression across breast cancers is a direct sum, as estimated by the model, of some noise, which is relatively modest, all on the same scale, a contribution from factor 1, and a contribution from factor 8. Okay, so there are two dimensions of activity, sub-pathway activation, if you like, underlying cyclin D fluctuations across samples. Am I supposed to dance? And there's some crap. This is one of those correction factors. And so what we plotted here, it's there are several more factors in the analysis, as I'll show you. We're just plotting those factors which significantly, 0.99, I think it was, contribute to fluctuations in the expression in this analysis. Okay. So it's a nice example because we can look, it's one of many examples we've got. We can go and look at the factor analysis, and we can say, well, what is factor 8? Well, let's look at the genes that have high pi's on factor 8 and high estimated betas, the genes that highly associate with factor 8. And we look in there and we see several representatives of the cyclin D gene that are on the F-O-matrix array. It's represented four times. And two or three other genes that are highly coordinately regulated with cyclin D. It's a cyclin D factor. And we look at factor 1, and it's an estrogen factor, estrogen receptor factor, ER factor. It's breast cancer data. Okay, ER is big in breast cancer. Because I know a lot about genes that associate with ER, because when we look down the column of pies from high to low, on the very large ones, because there are a lot of them, hundreds of ER-related genes, we find lots of friends in the ER pathway. So what this is giving us, we look at the values of the betas. One of them is 0.8 and one of them is 0.5. Okay, these are numbers. It's basically saying cyclin D variation across this breast cancer sample is about 80%, is about 0.8 cell cycle related fluctuations in cycle D, cell developmental fluctuations, and about 0.5 ER. Okay? And some crap and some noise. And this is nice because there are really two branches in the pathway that you have in mind for roles for the downstream activation of cyclin D. Here's cyclin D in the E2F pathway. Here's growth signals that excite, MYC, and drive cyclin D transcription to kick off the cell cycle. Here's a completely separate pathway, the ER pathway. It may not be active, okay? Estrogen plays lots of roles, but in many contexts it's not active. If it is active, well, ER is known to be a transcriber of cyclin D. Cyclin D is a direct target of ER. There's some positive feedback as well, but these are really the two known and very well studied mechanisms for promoting expression of cyclin D. And what this factor analysis does is just exhibit that in this kind of data. Okay, that's just a vignette to fix ideas. So now we're going to go back to the business of pushing a MYC signature into cancer data and recognizing it's going to be more complex. It's not going to be one-dimensional. It's going to be a set of factors. And hopefully those factors are going to help us think about how complex the pathways and their intersections are when it comes to the transcriptional response to MYC when we profile across breast samples. So here's the pathway again. We're going to jump in. MYC is the example. We could do it with any other signature defined in vitro or from anywhere else, from other data sets. And we're going to jump across, and we're going to do it in a fairly stylized way today because this is what we've become fond of in the last couple of years. Rather than just jumping in and saying, let's take all 50,000 probes on the array, project the signature and play about with factor analysis, you know, breast cancer biology is very complicated, so there'll be hundreds of factors, okay? We're interested in MYC. We're interested in the MYC pathway and the roles played by other genes that intersect into the MYC pathway, how that ties into other pathways, okay? So we're interested in starting with this canonical signature gene set and then moving around it genomically, okay? Here's one way we've been doing this that you might be interested in learning more about. We took 100 genes, okay, and did this analysis on those 100 genes, the signature gene set. And we discovered that we probably needed 6 factors to represent the statistical variation, covariation in a factor analysis across these 300 breast tumors. And then we ask the question, well, let me take factor 1 and ask the question, just its estimate across the breast tumors, of all the other thousands of genes, which seem to associate with it? Okay, so you can back up, fit all of the genes, and find the ones with a high pi. We do that approximately, because we want to do it repeatedly. This is the kind of picture you get. It says, well, most of the genes that are not in this set of 100, which we know are MYC-related, so are tied into these factors, have a very low probability or zero probability of being associated with that factor, but maybe one or two of them have a high probability. So they look interesting. They weren't in the signature gene set. They're representing part of the increased complexity, heterogeneity, diversity of the transcriptional patterns that we see in human tumor data compared to the cell line data. So expand the gene set and put them in the model. Look at factor 2, do the same thing. Look at factor 3, do the same thing. Refit the model where now the white indicates the original signature genes and the red are indicating the evolution of the analysis to look around, just that tight one-dimensional pathway, and to say what else might be playing. What else might be related to the factors as we estimate them that describe the patterns of expression in that signature when we evaluate it in human tissues? So most of the factors that we start with sort of get enriched with red bars, and there's one here, I think it's number 6, which is all red. A connectivity has been made in terms of a statistical set of activities that we're describing statistically as a new factor involving some of these genes that came from the signature gene set and some of the new ones they pulled in. The last example is just going to play that through and give you some again, it's just a couple of vignettes, just some insight into how we like to look at these analyses. In a more recent, this is about a year old now, study, not of drug response or pathway deregulation direct, but of tumor microenvironmental characteristics. I like this. This is mainly Ashley Chi on the biological side of Tube, who does the experimentation. And it generates all the ideas, of course, because this has to do with the environment in which a tumor is growing. Various nutrients, the acidity of various acids, environmental characteristics that you can intervene upon, and in some cases, in most cases, much more benignly with respect to downstream side effects than typical chemotherapies. Okay? It's easy to heat a human breast. Okay. In situ, and control and modify some of the environmental characteristics, some of the microenvironmental characteristics of this of the environment in which the tumor is growing. Okay. Very little is known about oxidation, and hypoxia has been studied to a degree. Lactic acidosis, it has been studied to a degree. There are many others. I could list about 15. And so what one is interested in here is experimental in vitro studies that study each of these, and this is what Ashley does for his main living, and look at the transcriptional response to find signatures and say, well, what am I going to do with it now? Well, let's look at some breast data. Let's move it over to the breast data and see the pathways that lactic acidosis seems to energize in lab experiments as they play out in real human studies. So this one here is lactic acidosis, which is a paper we wrote the end of last year, where the lab-based, this was breast epithelial cells, and the in vitro response to increasing lactic acidosis was defined. There is a signature gene set, or many possible ways of defining that. And it seems to contain genes. This was one of our students, Haiger Shen, who's now at Novartis. There's a whole other side of this that has to do with annotation that I don't have time to talk about today. It seems to tie into lots of things that one would expect. But also, the genes in there seem to tie into various published signatures and published pathway gene lists that relate to different measures of aggressiveness of development of tumors. Okay. Which is interesting, because if you can increase the lactate or the lactic acidosis or decrease it somehow magically in situ, and that has a link to outcome, and you can figure out that how to do the experiments to try and verify that it in fact is a causal link. Then that provides an opening and an opportunity to have a therapeutic impact. Okay, same game then. So we'll take a signature of lactic acidosis defined in breast epithelial cells in the lab, and we'll go to the breast data set. This is a different breast data set than my earlier one. 250 samples, and I've just ordered them so that it's blue to red. There's a spectrum of this signature across the breast samples. And then we run a factor analysis, and this analysis led to 10 factors. And this is a heat map across the samples of the variation levels of the estimated factors. And you can sort of see that the third one seems to line up a bit with the projected signature, okay? But the rest doesn't. And there's a skeleton matrix that shows you that the original signature gene is now in red, and then some others were brought in. It's mainly interesting because of the crosstalk, to begin to tie genes across the factors. We've got a number of examples where we've done this kind of signature extrapolation to human tissues, whether it be blood or various cancers or heart-based tissue, and the signature is gone. There is no signature. There's no variation in the projected signature. Okay? It's just a pathway that's inert in the study in the human data that we're looking at. Sometimes it works out that the signature is there, and it's picked up by one or two or more of the estimated factors. And this is just a heavily penalized linear regression model search that shows that basically factor three with a modifier for maybe one or two factors can do a job of replicating that projected signature. Another way to think about that is the reverse, that the signature's sort of broken down. This really has three dimensions in breast tumors, not just one. Okay, so there's several other pathways that lactic acidosis is feeding into in real human tissues. So part of the interest then is to go through and look at these factors, look at them in pictorial form and also in terms of the genes that have high probabilities of loading on these factors. I'm just going to pick out a couple of these today. The biologists might be interested in talking about some more of these. For example, these are the breast tumors reordered so that they are, the black line here is the projected lactic acidosis signature. So they're increasing with lactic acidosis. Factor 3, the red curve sort of recapitulates that to a degree. There are a number of factors that came in here that are very interesting to us. We picked up a factor. Some of these genes play into a very clear association with progesterone receptor levels, not ER, for those of you that know about tumor biology, hormone biology. We pick up a signature, a couple of signatures that seem to be, and the LA predictor itself, that seem to be related to known gene expression based pathways that associate with markers of different kinds of aggressiveness, metastasis, and other risk factors. We picked up one that was completely unexpected, I'll mention in a minute. And we picked up one I didn't put on here, factor 6 isn't on there. This was a very surprising connection that was made for the biologist. This has to do with a transcription factor called AKT. And the reason I haven't put it on there is that the biologists don't want to. The grant goes in before 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time today. We've got a whole series of experiments that have just completed that have done a series of functional studies to look at lactic acidosis on the AKT pathway. And lo and behold, that was predicted from this analysis, and lo and behold, it's verified that there is, in fact, a direct role for lactic acidosis in inhibiting AKT. And AKT plays into a lot of physiological endpoints in breast cancer development. Okay. So that's part of how we're interested in using these models, and now and again, it seems to be working out positively. The next slide is a statistical slide, for those of you that care about it. Point to the top factor here. I plotted this one, factor 2, differently than the others. I just put a dot plot with some red and some blue. In this data set, we have mutational status on P53. Okay, the P53 pathway that controls cell death, cell fate. So P53 mutants are in red, and P53 wild types are in blue. Okay, and so this has nothing to do with lactic acidosis. It's just that some of the genes that were discovered as part of this analysis happen to be related to the P53 pathway, happen to lie in it, and happen to show variation in expression concordantly. That associate that show you up the difference between the wild type and the mutant P53. The statistical point is that if you take these dots and look at them on the vertical axis and draw a histogram, it's a non-Gaussian histogram. Okay, there's really two groups, some in the middle. And just for the passing, these models are non-Gaussian and sort of semi-parametric in the factor domain. And the reason we think that's important sometimes is that just a couple of examples to show you why. Here are two ER-regulated genes from this data. So the crosses are just a scatter plot of the expression values across the tumors. And the contours are predictions from this model. Okay, so it looks sort of Gaussian, which is nice. Both highly expressed genes. Here are another couple of genes that are in the HER2 ERBB2 pathway, okay, another hormonal pathway that's very important in breast cancer. And for which most people, two-thirds of women, are down here at sort of high nominal levels of variation in expression of these two genes, highly positively related. And then there's a group, I don't know whether it's amplification or just upregulation, it's probably amplification, about a third of breast tumors are up there. Okay, so there's really a couple of subgroupings, whether Gaussian or not, it doesn't really matter, but it's certainly a non-Gaussian picture. The model is showing you the picture is showing you how the model recapitulates it. There are other examples like this. This is an ER-regulated gene in HER2 itself, and you begin to see some structure there that some people would say is subtypes of tumors. I don't tend to think in those terms. You know, it's a spectrum. It's a spectrum. But it's highly non-Gaussian. There's various groupings and non-Gaussianity here that you want to be able to reflect in a predictive model. Okay. So the latent factor models that we have here for the statisticians have non-parametric Bayesian models over the latent factor space that allow us to do that. Okay, well, I got 5 minutes left, and I'm about done. I've got two more slides. On the lactic acidosis story, just to hit a couple of points. Okay, coming back now to the to one of the sort of global motivating interests of being able to look at expression-based biomarkers of things that that matter, such as risk, such as outcome of various kinds in cancer, drug responsiveness, and so on and so forth. So the sort of, for me, typical way of thinking about this, as we've described, is to say, well, let's have a signature and let's see if that signature associates with recurrence of cancer or with a response to drug A, B, up to drug 10,000. And now what we've done is moved into a regime where we're projecting signatures and understanding that the complexity of real tumors, or what we see when we take expression from blood, is hugely different to what we see in the lab. So that projection has been elaborated. The signature has been dissected. It's been moved from one to however many dimensions we need to really understand how the genes that play in that pathway that was interrogated play into other pathways. So now the game, presumably, is not that the signature is the predictor, but it's that elaborated version of the signature, the factors in this particular stylized analysis that represent the variation in that signature in the tumors. It's how they now relate to the endpoints which becomes interesting, because the endpoints are functions of tumor biology, okay, and environment. And it's all of those pathways, cumulatively, that define the life course of that tumor. Okay, and we may have a mixed signature that's broken up into 17 components, reflecting lots of different ways MYC is being intervened upon and is influencing other genes in living tumors. So in this study of this set of 250 breast cancers, this is just an example of that kind of thinking. What I have here is the same kind of just crude survival plot, just splitting the data into two, 125, 125. First, by doing it with the projected lactic acidosis signatures. We learned from this study, this was Ashley's first step, that lactic acidosis is a good prognostic marker for outcome in breast cancer. This was a surprise. And the gray lines here show you the two Kaplan-Meier curves for the two halves of this particular sample, stratified just on that projected marker, high risk and low risk. When you take the factors, the fitted values of the factors from the factor analysis, it does a slightly better job. Okay? Build a little survival model, it does a better job of stratification. The extra complexity underlying lactic acidosis is represented by three or four factors. It's picking up more subtle distinctions in the tumors and is able to pull them apart a bit more. And so you say, well, what if I look at other breast samples? Okay, this is the data we were fitting the model to. So we did that. We pulled in four additional breast samples, very widely varying in terms of the patient types and the outcomes, and from all over the world. And we directly projected the estimated factors into the factor model onto these new data sets. Okay, we didn't do any refitting. We just took posterior means and pushed them over. Okay, and did exactly the same thing, just a 50-50 split. Okay, so this is pure prediction. And lo and behold, in every case, even in a case of very low risk women, ER negative, small numbers of lymph nodes, very low risk women, we find the same phenomenon recapitulated. So purely predicting across several additional studies from all over the place, we find the same ability of this refinement of the projected signature to improve the description. Not only does it improve the description of the association between the gene expression markers and the phenotype, but it allows you to go in and dissect it and say, well, which of those factors are really contributing most to this? Okay. Is it a druggable pathway, or is it really just that we need to increase the acidity? It's that kind of thinking that's driving this idea. And this is in a paper. Joe Lucas was my student postdoc who was responsible for most of this work. Final point, since I'm at the time limit, Joe, this is also Joe's work. One of the factors that came up there was a factor that's associated with blood coagulation and phosphate transport and other things that I know nothing about, and was a surprise. And the biologist actually didn't know what to do with this. And so we spent some time in the literature. And this led to tamoxifen. And those of you that know about this stuff will know that blood coagulation and phosphate transport are really important in the efficacy of tamoxifen, the best So it's an ER receptor blocker for ER-positive tumors. And Joe went out and found another, yet another breast cancer data set, which had been from a tamoxifen trial, and did exactly the same thing, projected just this factor onto these tumors and just did a 50-50 split of the data to look at survival. And lo and behold, what happens is that for women that were treated with tamoxifen, there's a really quite substantial separation into high risk and low risk. Okay, it's really a tamoxifen responsiveness predictor in many ways, completely unrelated to ER, but it's getting at the biochemical action of tamoxifen in gene expression profiles based on tumor data, arising from the lactic acidosis pathway and its interactions with various other pathways that play into the tumor biology. Okay, well, with that, I'm done. I talked through a few examples and a few vignettes, really, which utilize various statistical things, regression analysis when you don't know the predictor variables, factor analysis, with some concern for making sure stuff is there, sparsity modeling that helps you really focus in and zoom in on things. Questions about protecting against artifacts in experimental data, whether you're doing it in one lab on one day with the same people, or whether you're doing it over time, or whether you're combining together lots of different data sets. Very, very important part of the business. You can go to my website for papers. I put our integrative cancer biology program website on here because that's got a richer array of biological papers and ideas as to what we're about on that side of the examples that I talked about today that may interest some people. These guys are the biologists who do all the biology and a lot of statistics, actually, loads of statistics. And this is a few of the key students and postdocs and past students and postdocs who work more on the statistical side. And with that, Soren, thank you for your time.
So tumors are often heterogeneous in terms of the cell types that are involved. How much of your variability in the factor loadings do you think is intracellular variation, and how much is variability in the cell type composition?
Okay, did everybody get the question? Did you hear the question? Okay. So the question is, when you take stuff out of a tumor, cells out of a tumor, you get what you get. Okay, all kinds of cell types. You might think you're going after cancerous cells only, but you'll get some healthy cells of various kinds, stromal cells, epithelial cells. You'll get contamination of various kinds coming in. So how much of what you see when you fit any statistical model is crap? And how much of it is diversity of expression that you're seeing because of the mix of cell types? And how much is it? Oh, okay. So that's the question. And of course, the answer is, well, all kinds of stuff happens because you're matching up lots of cells. But does it matter? Because if what you care about is characterizing transcriptional data in samples of breast tumors taken out of the next patient at Addenbrooke's hospital or at some boondocks hospital in North Carolina, that is going to feed into an analysis that will help you understand where the patient sits on some multidimensional spectrum, drug response relatedness, risk related, then you've got to buy all of that stuff, because that's always going to be there. And so that's interesting and important to understand that that's the variation that you want to measure. Now, if you want to go back and say, well, are we seeing a clean breast epithelial cell signature broken up in a slightly more refined way? The answer is, of course, no, because we're looking at the mishmash of cells that we get. We're doing this, by the way, on the point, this kind of study now across a panel of breast cancer cell lines, which is getting more, it's the same general set of questions. So if you take, you culture cells from a tumor, okay, diversity of cells, we've got about 100 breast cancer cell lines that are being studied in this context to look at the same kinds of questions. How does the transcriptional response to MYC or lactic acidosis differ now in vitro as a function of cell type or breast cancer cells, but still very different? Okay, and it's getting away from that in situ tumor-based complexity to look in a more refined way at the pathway activation questions and the basic biology. But the clinical endpoint, it's a very different story, because that's, you know, with microarray data and current methods of getting microarray data, that's what you have to accept that and you have to deal with it. Okay? Now, other technologies will come along to replace it.
I'm not 100% sure that I'm convinced by this argument that because you're sampling over a large number of potential cases of things that could go wrong, like sampling additional tissue that you don't need, which could be variable quantities and variable types between individuals, is going to be inclusive enough to predict what a patient is going to give. Because first of all, are you sampling enough of what could go, what is different from what you think it is? So are you sampling enough of different scenarios of quantity of the wrong tissue, nature of the wrong tissue, so that you're, that inference that you're making from the sample of building that multidimensional space is enough to then place properly the new sample that is coming. What I'm thinking, what I'm worried is that the number of cases that things could go wrong is larger than the space of expression that you're exploring, which means that you can actually push things in the same direction for completely different reasons. And I'm not challenging it, I'm just not sure that it's that simple. Right?
I gave you the impression it was simple.
No.
Let me restate what might have been a question behind what you just described, which I think was a very cogent and very apt series of statements. More data is better. Right? So one view of statistical modeling is that there will be some data. It arises from a population. Okay? The definition of statistics, really. We're interested in population variation. From whatever data we see, we are going to characterize that data in order to represent the population. And as we see more data, we will change our characterization. And lots of things can go wrong. We're in the lab, and I think I've highlighted some of our thinking on that. And in all of these models, there's a plus epsilon. And sometimes that's really big. And sometimes that's all that matters. Okay. So statistics at this level is about characterizing variation. All right, and then digging inside the models and beginning to say, well, can we interpret some of the pieces of the model that we've used to characterize that variation? And it is the case, and I've given you three or four or five examples here of several, and many actually, where that pieces of that characterization do overlay known biology, do stand up under functional study, do have predictive validity in a clinical context. There are other cases where we don't see that. And there are cases where pieces of the model certainly reflect other ways in which things can go wrong. So for example, the factor analysis is a very rich framework. And in most of our studies, in many of our studies, we find factors emerging. We've done everything we can to deal with assay artifact, and we've got errors in there and so forth. We see factors emerging, and they emerge because they reflect patterns of variation across the samples that are common to several or many genes that are obviously reflecting things that go wrong that we didn't anticipate in the model. Okay? So the short answer is more data is good, as long as you have a model that is flexible and responsive enough, and then you overlay that with care and interpretation. Okay.
Okay, I think we should thank Mike again.